Welcome to the Student of the Game Fire Podcast with your host, Danny B. Today's guest is Jim Walsh, 22 years of combination experience, a retired Division Chief of Training with Winter Park Fire Department, creator, founder, and OG of Vent Enter Search, connoisseur of anything related to truck work. Growing up, Jim wanted to become a pilot in the armed forces, but in life, not everything is guaranteed to play out the way we would like. Jim found the next best thing, and for him it was the fire service. Once Jim got his foot in the door, it was all gas and no brakes, surrounding himself with individuals who were into the job and climbing up the ranks along the way. I hope the listeners can find value in this conversation I had with Jim when it comes to taking care of yourself and remembering that your family matters. With that, I present Jim Walsh.
Well, my name's Jim Walsh, and I recently retired from Winter Park Fire Department. Winter Park Fire Department is located in Central Florida, and I had a really great career, but kind of a little bit how it got started. I actually was going to high school. I was going to a boarding school, a military boarding school, because I wanted to be an F-16 pilot. I wanted to be in the Air Force, and that was going to be my thing. And that's all that I wanted to do in life. And I was going through my annual physical for my flight certification, my junior year. And I was told that I would probably be too tall to become an F-16 pilot. And that's all I wanted to do was be an F-16 pilot. You'll probably learn about me that when I go into something, I go all in. And so once I figured out I couldn't be an F-16 pilot, I'm like, okay, what's next? I want to do something different. And my father was a New York City cop growing up. And so I kind of knew that there was one of three things I wanted to do in life, because I wanted a pension. And so what I wanted to do is I wanted to either be in the military, I wanted to be a cop, or I wanted to be a firefighter. That was it. Those were my only choices in my mind. And so when all that happened, I was like, you know what? My dad already did the cop thing. He did well with that. Military, I can't get the spot I want. I'm going to go all in the fire service. And that's exactly what I did. And I enjoyed every minute of it. I started going to school. I started going to college right out of high school, thinking I was going to get my college degree before I started the fire service. And after some time, a couple semesters, the university and I decided I wasn't fit for school at that time. I was a little too busy partying and having fun and not focusing on my academics. So that was right when I started going to EMT school and fire school and everything like that. And that's kind of how I got started into the career. Specifically, what I ended up doing, and this is kind of a unique part of the story, is I actually started off as a fire inspector, because back then in my agency in Winter Park, in order to become a fire inspector there, you had to have your fire school or fire standards, we call it. So standards, EMT, and fire inspector. And so back then the job market wasn't so great. And so I'd already had my standards and EMT, and I was just looking to get a job. I was volunteering and everything, having a great time with that. And I decided, you know what, I'm going to go to this fire inspector school, thinking that I would never do this ever in my entire life. And so, but I just wanted to make myself more marketable as a firefighter EMT. And so I went to fire inspector school, and then a friend of mine called me from fire inspector school, and he goes, hey, you know, Winter Park is hiring fire inspectors. And I go, man, I'd love to be a work in Winter Park, but I have no desire to be a fire inspector. I want to be a firefighter. You know, that was all I wanted to do. I was already a volunteer, you know, and that was it. And so anyway, I ended up going, taking the test, and I passed the test, and I got hired on as a fire inspector at 21 years old. Wow. And it was, at that point I was like, great. Now I need to learn all about being a fire inspector, because I really wasn't paying attention in school. And that's kind of how my career got started. And I spent like a little bit over a year, like 13 months in fire prevention. And then I went on shift as a firefighter in Winter Park. I had to retest and everything like that, but now I was already a city employee. And so I went on shift as a firefighter, and that was kind of how the early part of my career started. But I tell you, and this is what's kind of an interesting thing, I'm really glad that I did the fire prevention thing first. And I know that sounds weird, because I'm a firefighter through and through. I mean, that is me. That is what I am. That's what I do. And but it made me understand the city in a way that I could never have understood it any other way. And I got an appreciation for things that made me more successful throughout my career, like building construction and area familiarization and just codes and standards and the things that firefighters don't really like to talk about. They don't really love. It's not sexy. I get it, but that's the stuff that's more important. I wouldn't say more important, but it's just as important. And so that's kind of a kind of quick snapshot about how I got started into the career. And
With, I guess, would you say the fact that you've had, or you were an inspector side, it gives you a little bit more appreciation to inspectors out there in the country? Because sometimes firemen can be a little abrasive towards inspectors, but like
No.
they really do have an important role if you think about it.
Absolutely. But I know that it's important to realize that a lot of inspectors don't, a lot of departments create a little bit of a divide between prevention and inspection or prevention and shift work. And I wish that wasn't the case. And so some departments, and I don't think it's intentional, it's just how it is. There's just a big divide, and that cannot be the case. That cannot be the case. And it is very important, especially, I don't, I mean, every city was probably like this, but the times, the years that I was in Winter Park, there was so much development and so many changes and so many significant changes about building construction that had to influence our tactics, which then had to influence our apparatus specification and all these different things. But it all came down to, fire prevention type stuff and all of that. And because of the good relationship we had with our fire inspectors, we had a kind of a better understanding about things. We learned about things earlier in the opera, earlier in the planning stages and stuff like that. And it was really important. So I think fire prevention is a really important thing in the fire service. And I know a lot of fire departments don't have a good re not relationship because they're all in this, you wear the same uniform, but it has to be like an ongoing. For example, we always used to have our fire marshal in our staff meetings with at the chief officer level and stuff like that, because it was he would, every week he would come in and say, hey, this is what's coming up in the city. This is what's, we have this major planned event, or we have this building being built in the city, or the new type of construction. And that was just important,
No, definitely. Okay. All right. And so you said, I believe you said you did about 14 months or so in the prevention in the bureau, and then you switched over to firefighter. So when you switched over, did you have to go through any sort of academy or anything like that?
Yeah, so I'd already had my state certification for firefighter and everything, and at this point I'd already started learning the Winter Park tactics and different things, but I definitely had to go through a whole testing process again. I had to test like I was a new person off the street, and I had to take the firefighter tests and everything like that. But I'd already had the background check and all those different things. Back then, we really didn't have any sort of orientation program back then. So basically I was put on shift and they're like, hey, you know the city enough and you're good, and just basically, here, put your bunker gear on that engine tomorrow, and shift starts for you. You're on C shift now. Have a good day, kind of thing. And that's kind of how it started. Since then, our department has definitely created a new hire academy and a couple of weeks of training and all of that stuff, which so we've definitely grown up. It was really interesting because even though the fire department, when I started the fire department in 1998, the fire department was 98 years old at the time. The department started in April of 2000 or 1900, but in it's still there were a lot of things we needed to grow. And so from 1998 until now, or certainly when I left, there was tremendous growth in the agency and the professionalism in the agency and all those different things. So it's definitely better now than it was. But it's not as good as when I was there. Let's just make sure make sure that's clear.
Was Winter Park always on the list, or was it just one of the departments that you applied for when you wanted a fire department job?
Yeah, so that's a really good question. So I had actually worked in Winter Park, but not for Winter Park. So I just worked, I was doing computer stuff at the time, and I was very familiar with the agency and the city and stuff like that. And it was on my list, but back then the job market was crazy. You would have hundreds of people that had all their certifications testing for one or two spots in an agency. So honestly, at that point, it was just get a job, get a job, get a job. But once I realized that inspector thing was going to be a good in for me in Winter Park, I was like, wait a second, and so I really got to see the agency from inside as an employee and realize that yes, it was definitely a place I wanted to work. I can tell you, it wasn't perfect then. It was a great department, but they still were doing some not growing pains, but they were just evolving. And I was really glad that I was able to kind of be a part of that. And a lot of my friends, growing up in the fire service, always wanted me to go to some of the bigger agencies. Certainly the city of Orlando is right next to us, and I had really, really good friends in the city of Orlando that I was, going on vacation with and hanging out with. And those are my folks, Winter Park guys as well, don't get me wrong. But and everybody was like, you got to go to Orlando, you got to go to Orlando. And I'm like, you know what, I think I'm gonna hang out here in Winter Park, and I'm gonna make this agency what I want it to be. And I wasn't thinking that I was gonna become the fire chief. That wasn't even on my radar back then, but I knew that I could make some differences. And if it was at the company level, I was gonna be fine with that. And if it was at the shift level, I was gonna be fine with that. But I just wanted to make an impact in the organization in that way. And I felt that an agency the size of Winter Park, I was able to, it was like a high speed, low drag type of situation. We were going to be able to make moves on it. I know now that some of the larger agencies, like City of Orlando is a couple hundred people, Orange County, which is the county we are in, there's over 1,000 employees there. So, and they have 42 stations or something like that, 43 stations. So, that's going to be a big ship to move. And I wanted to move quick. And so Winter Park was definitely on my radar for that reason.
Okay. And so with that being said, what was your first assignment, and what was your first assignment, and did you seek out individuals that you wanted to emulate as far as loving the job?
Yes. So my first assignment was we call it tailboard in Winter Park. We call it, so it was. So I was a firefighter on engine 60 at C shift, and engine 60 at the time was a single engine station, and it was a really, really cool place. That was like the west side of Winter Park. So we had two stations that were within probably a half mile of each other. But the reason why that sounds weird, but knowing the geography of Winter Park, we actually had train tracks that went through the city, and the train would frequently stop and split the city in half right there, and basically cut the city in half. So we had to have units on both sides of the city, both sides of the tracks, rather. And on engine 60, that side of town definitely caught more fire. So that was awesome. It's not that we were all fighting fire every day, but we were definitely making fires and having some fun with that. And so at that time, and I hate to say this, but at that time, we had some great people in Winter Park, and there were definitely things I was learning from people in Winter Park. But Winter Park at the time, it was very, I wouldn't say incestual, but it was just everybody was just like learning their only way. We didn't have a lot of people going to outside training or outside classes and stuff like that at that time. So what I did was I definitely learned my craft and learned the Winter Park way of doing things, and had some mentors, if you will, or people that I looked up to in the agency. But I really went out of the agency and took classes outside and got some different perspectives and looked at some other people to learn from them. And that is actually what probably impacted my career more than anything else, right?
Right. Okay. So at what point did you decide to start moving up the ranks and why?
Yeah. So early in my career, I think I just wanted to make an impact. That's what I really wanted to be able to do that. And so I wanted to be an engineer. That was one of the first things I had to do. So we have a promoted engineer position, driver operator position. And I wanted to be specifically the engineer on the ladder truck. But at that time, we didn't even have a dedicated truck company. So it wasn't until I became an engineer that we had a dedicated truck company. And that doesn't make sense right now, but I'll probably expand on that in a second. Once I realized the engineer position, I was like, you know what? This is awesome. I love that. I'd have still been an engineer to this day, especially now that we have tillers. I'd have stayed there on that, you know, that would have been the spot. But back then, in Winter Park, promotions were few and far between. We had people, everybody stayed there. People didn't leave. They only left for retirement. And the way the department was growing and stuff like that, we just didn't have a lot of people leaving. So promotions were few and far between. And the other thing, the interesting thing of our promotional lists, because of the way we're set up with the Civil Service Board, our promotional lists are only good for 6 months. And so it's not like we have this constant list. So basically back then, if you were even thinking about promotion and there was an opportunity, you had to take it and run with it and go for it. And so, yeah, so I did the training, or I did the engineer thing for a while. That was fantastic and I loved it. And then at that point at this point now, we were starting to get really aggressive with some things and stuff like that. And for years, we did not have a dedicated training officer. So then they created a dedicated training officer. And I promoted into, I went through the lieutenant's promotion so I could promote into that position. And I ultimately became a training captain before I became chief and stuff like that. So that's kind of where it was quick how it went. Like I wasn't in any one of the spots as long as I wanted to be, but again, in Winter Park with our size agency and the way the lists were going and stuff like that, it's like you had to take advantage when the opportunity presented itself. Right.
Mm-hmm. Okay. With that being said, this next question is not to brag or boast, but I genuinely want to hear the steps that you took to get Winter Park. I don't want to say it solely fell on you, but to go from like you guys currently now have an engine truck model, you know, specific tasks, standards.
Yes.
How did you go about getting that? Because there are a lot of departments out there, I'm sure, or there are individuals in a training captain or chief's position that would like to get their department towards that course, that heading, but they don't know how to do that.
Right. Yeah. So I can tell you it was a super uphill battle. However, it was a deputy chief that was the impact, and then he ended up becoming the fire chief. So ultimately, when I went into training, it was the fire chief was he was a firefighter's firefighter, like he were okay. A firefighter's fire chief kind of thing. Super super great guy. He ended up becoming a fantastic mentor of mine. I would not have gotten anywhere in my career without his guidance and leadership and stuff like that. And that was Jim White. Fantastic, fantastic person to work with and work for and stuff like that. But he was all about the truck stuff, and he liked the idea of truck stuff and everything else. And so when he was still the deputy is how we created our truck company. And at mm-hmm. first we had a, originally we had a 75 foot Sutphin, single axle Sutphin, like Quint basically.
Okay.
And we just had that for ISO purposes and stuff like that. And he and then our battalion chief on C shift let us start assigning ourselves truck functions on every fire. And so once we started doing that, because we had a bunch of people that were motivated on that truck or on that unit and that were working together and everything, taking truck classes and doing all these different things and training all the time. And once that was happening, the deputy chief at the time, Chief White, And our battalion chief were like, "Hey, let's try this model. Let's try this model." So we just started assigning ourselves. We were still called Engine 61 at the time, just happened to have an aerial on there. And he was just like, "Hey, let's just start assigning this unit truck work for every fire." And we started doing that, and things started getting better. And fires are going better, and fires are going out quicker. And it was like, wait a second. So even though we're a small agency, we can still have a dedicated unit doing performing dedicated functions, and it works well. And even though our city was only nine square miles, we had three firehouses in 9 square miles because there's a lot of lakes in between here and there. And so you really our drive time is a little bit difficult to go from here to there. So it was it worked out really well. And so we started doing this model, and like I said, fires are going out quicker. This is the success rate of things were just getting better. Probably because it was C shift. I just want to throw that out there for my A shift and B shift brothers. But besides that, it was just things were going really well. And so as the department was growing, that was when Chief White, again, he was the deputy chief at the time, said, "Hey, let's look at an actual dedicated truck company." So we ended up getting, at first, we ended up getting a 100-foot Pierce platform. But we just had three people on the unit, still three people. And again, things were going really well and stuff like that. And then shortly thereafter, we ended up putting the fourth person on the unit. And that's where the magic happened. Once we were able to start splitting up into inside team and outside team truck functions and doing all those things, that's when the doors blew off and everything started happening well. At the same time, we also got people involved in really focusing on being good engine companies. So we realized that, hey, even though we're the smaller agency, if we just specialize in truck company stuff, rescue company stuff, engine company stuff, if we just specialize a little bit, we're still master, we can still do it all. However, if we specialize in it and we plan on it, and then we started writing it into our SOGs that the truck will always do this, the engine will always do this, so on and so forth. And again, just magic kind of started happening. And it was a grind, making it sound like it was super easy. I mean, there was a lot of late nights spent on this, even when I was the engineer and then became the training officer, all these different things, but it just worked. It just worked.
And I'm assuming in order to get your people, the individuals of Winter Park, the boots on the ground on board, training was implemented, and you guys had to work on deficiencies and areas that you weren't,
Yeah.
100% in.
Yeah. And that was tough because in order to kind of flip the switch there, we kind of had to prove to each other and to ourselves that we weren't perfect and that we had so many things to learn and so on and so forth. I remember early on in my training when I was the training officer, we were just doing the I think they're NFPA 1410 evolutions. Just initial company functions, like, hey, so an engine company is going to come, they're going to lay a 300-foot line, and they're going to operate two hand lines and just do that. And then we started off, so we started doing all these different evolutions, and we were timing them, and people were, and at first, again, as the new training officer, some people were getting upset. They were like, "Man, you're just breaking our stones, and you're doing this." I'm like, "No, I'm just trying to prove to us that we all can do better." And then people were doing some training on the side before the training, right? Before the company training, before the department training, they were doing company level training, and they were showing up better prepared and everything. And we had people like our company officers were really buying off on helping train their probationary firefighters. They got new firefighters about, hey, this is what it's going to be. Listen, you're going to be on the engine company. You're not going to be on the truck. You're not ready for that. You're going to be on the engine company. And I'm an engine officer. So I'm going to teach you how to be a good engine person." And so again, it allowed everybody to specialize in things. Again, everybody knew each other's job. But once we got into that level of detail and our SOGs start, like, so for example, our SOG, we had it written in our SOG that the truck company was going to get an all clear and 4 minutes or less. Okay. Cool. Just a great benchmark. It was a great benchmark to put on in our SOG. Well, or SOP, SOG, whatever. Well, at first that wasn't that, and some of our structures in Winter Park, that wasn't possible, you know, especially some of our homes in Winter Park. In Winter Park, you might have on the same street, you might have an 800 square foot home right next to, and I'm not joking, an 18,000 square foot home on the same street, right? So you, unless you know the specific house number, you don't know what you're pulling up to. Is it going to be something where you can just stretch a pre-connect line and you're good, like one line and you're done kind of thing? Or is it going to be an extended line operation because the house is so large, right? So we just started getting, and it was, like I said, it was painful, but it was consistent, and we just kept going and getting better and better and better. And it ended up starting to work out well, you know?
How do you get individuals to realize you're not trying to harp on their mistakes? You're just trying to get them to realize that they can do better without hurting feelings.
Man, if I knew how to do that, I would still, we could bottle this up and sell it. I think people realized, and there's some fun stories about this, and every person, it was different. It was slow and stuff like that. And some of these guys didn't even come out to me with how impactful the training was and stuff like that till after I retired. And now some of the retirees will get together and they'll be like, you know what, man, I thought you were breaking my stones that whole time, but you made us good. You made us really good. And you know what? I always appreciated going to your training, and I knew it was going to be fun, and I knew it was going to be hard, and I knew you were going to have some challenges for us, but I knew it was going to be fair, and I knew it was going to be what we would expect in our agency. You know, I never trained on the things that, like, oh my gosh, this could, you know, never happen in our city, but we've got to be prepared for it. We never got to that point. I wanted to be perfect on as much as we could. I wanted to be perfect on the calls we ran every day, the types of fires that we ran every day. That was what's most important to me. And so I just kind of tried to build it from there, but I always, and I built our training schedule to always go back to the basics. It was the, you know, yeah, we might have all this, like, for example, I remember when all the active shooter training and all that stuff came on, that was starting to consume big portions of our training schedule. And I'm like, we have to take a pause from this and go back to some of those company drills. They're like, we've been doing these every month for, you know, so on and so forth. It's like, but this is where it matters. You know, we got to, okay, we just filled our mind with all these new things, which is important. Don't get me wrong, it's super important, right? But we got to go back to the basics and say, hey, this is what it's going to take to get that initial initial line stretched, you know? And that's, you know, and that's what's important, you know? And now I still, this is so great to see. And I don't follow a lot of the stuff that still the department's up to these days, but, you know, I still some, you know, because of Eric Wheaton, I see a bunch of the stuff on social media and stuff like that. And it's like, you know, I'll see like initial operation going, like unit lines in the door and stuff like that. And I'm like, man, they're just dialed in. And it's just, and I know how much work went on, and I'm not saying work that I did. Mm-hmm. I'm saying how much work went in to getting the department at that level, to operate at that level, right?
Right. Right. Okay. So you move up to training captain or captain over training. What notion pushed you to go even further to hold division chief?
Yeah, that was so I was just doing the training thing, and I was loving the training thing. I didn't want to do anything else. It was just, that was my passion. But unfortunately, with a smaller department, sometimes you end up getting, you know, last line of your job description is always other duties as assigned, right? And so with our agency and how it was expanding and stuff like that, and then how specific I was getting with all the things I was doing with the training and stuff like that, I started getting into just doing like apparatus specification, because I was training everybody to do things the right way and everything, but we had to go back all the way back to making sure our rigs were set up the right way. Well, the only way to get your rigs are set up right way is to get involved in the apparatus specification. So I would still do my training stuff, but then all of a sudden I got started involving in the apparatus specification and all these other things. And so it became very apparent to the agency that I was doing much more than just training. So what they ended up doing was reclassifying my position from just training chief to division chief of training. And then other duties as assigned. It was actually, I think what they said as a division chief was it was safety, training, and oh, health, safety and training. My gosh, I can't even remember the exact title, but it was those type of things. Oh, because then I started getting involved, very involved with making sure our members had proper medical physicals. We'd always had medical physicals, but then I got very involved with making sure that we had the proper medical physicals. Ultimately, interestingly enough, that medical physical that I fought for all those years and we ended up getting and everything like that, ultimately was what forced me to retire out because it was something I wasn't going to be able to pass.
Right.
And people, when I say that to people, they're like, oh my gosh, that you basically caused your own career demise, or whatever. And it's like, no, actually, because what we did for that medical physical, what we started doing in that, it helped people. It helped our firefighters. We had firefighters very early on ended up getting cancer diagnoses. So they were able to get treatment and come back to the job without a problem. The expectancy of our retirees has gone up significantly because people aren't retiring out because they have a career-ending injury or something that they're going to die from in a couple of years. They're just getting better. And I'm saying that the physical did all of that, but it was a portion of it. So, yeah, I'm sorry. I think I was getting long-winded and I forgot the specific question there, but that's kind of what it was all about.
Okay. And because you have the knowledge and the experience, would you say it's easier to spec equipment, gear, apparatus towards the way a department wants to work compared to just, well, we'll buy what we can take and then make it work for us?
Here's the thing. You can't, you are the citizens that pay our salaries or the citizens that give us the privilege to protect them. They expect us to be the best equipped, best prepared firefighters, whatever. That's what they expect. We understand that sometimes because of other things that can't always happen or whatever, but just they expect a lot from us. So why could we spend at this point, I know my prices are gonna be a little off, but how could we spend $550,000, $600,000 on a fire engine and it not be exactly what we need for our city? Why are we gonna take a square peg and put it in our round hole of a city? That makes no sense at all. Whereas if we just took more time, if somebody that really understood what the agency needs and stuff like that. So we're not listening to the salesman. We're not listening to the trend in the agency or the trend in the business or whatever. We're doing what's we're setting up a rig that's going to work for our city, right? And it takes a little bit more time, right? It does take a little bit more time and it takes a little bit more effort, but you have to have people that are willing to do that, put that work in, and probably more importantly, you have to have administrators or department administration that are willing to give people the time and the effort and all those things to make those decisions, right? Because that's the most important part. And again, we were very blessed at that time to have a fire chief that understood that and people that wanted to be a part of it, and they just allowed it to happen. I say it just allowed to happen. Trust me, there were a lot of fights upstairs with staff meetings and stuff like, not fights, but there were a lot of discussions and all these things, but it was we were very fortunate to have people that were willing to put in the work, the extra work. Like here's for this is a great example. So when we got our first tiller truck, it was a crazy thing. Like there were only two departments in Florida that had tillers at the time, and only it was Tampa and Jacksonville. We heard maybe there may have been one down South Florida, but we weren't 100% sure on that. But anyway, so we were the third or fourth to get one in Florida, and we were the first in Central Florida. And so my crews that I was training to be the firefighter, to be the tiller operators and stuff like that, we would do the training all day long, right? They were on shift, they were doing the training all day long. And then after the training, they would come and they would have dinner at the firehouse or whatever. And then they would spend hours that evening, hours working into the night. I'm talking, they were sending me pictures at 2 or 3 in the morning, but they're inside of the compartments, building things, the shelves and stuff like that, and setting things up the way we wanted it. And, so we had tremendous buy-in, and only because everybody realized that it was going to be that impactful for us, right?
Okay. With that being said, where did your love of truck work come from?
So, gosh, that's a really good question. I don't know that I've even been asked that question. I just it was when I was early in my career, I realized that it was something that we were not doing in our agency. And I started watching videos, and this was YouTube wasn't much of a thing back then or whatever, but I would watch videos and stuff like that and realize that, hey, the departments that are being successful, they have dedicated truck companies. So I was like, okay, let me start doing it. And so we also started doing some classes. Some of us on shift at the firefighter level were starting to take some of these classes and stuff like that, and talking to, our brothers and sisters over at Orlando Fire Department, because they had more dedicated truck companies. And once we realized that it was really kind of what we were missing in our agency and our tactics and all those things, that's just kind of where it kind of started. That was kind of the motivation to get there. And then it was just a very it was just a long process, but it was a process that nobody ever gave up on, and we kept wanting to get better and stuff like that. And to this day, again, I've been away from the agency for a number of years. To this day, I see pictures and videos of them doing it, and they're still keeping that same mentality that we had to create over those years. But it's the new firefighters, the new tiller operators, the new truck company people, it's all they know. And that's why they want to be there. And that's what's really cool, is it's like, listen, you can make all the changes you want in the agency and take my name off of things or whatever. It wasn't about me. It was about what's better for the citizens of Winter Park. And to this day, they're still doing it. And that's what's awesome, right?
Definitely. Okay. What occurred or what sparked the notion for Vent Enter Search? Because talking to Chief Wheaton, you are the OG of Vent Enter Search.
Yes, sir. So that was back, to put it in perspective, that was in like 2005, 2006 when that started. I think the first post on Vendor Search was April 1st of 2006. I had to go back and look at some notes to figure that out, but it was a long time. The way that started was, we had started so Winter Park had we'd had our truck company, and we were, it was our peers, our platform, and we had and so we started a truck company. A bunch of us were instructors at the fire college, and bunch of us put together a truck class, and we started teaching truck class at the fire college. And for the first time we did this truck class, there were four of the main there were I think it was four or five main instructors. It was five main instructors. And basically we started our morning session. We're like, hey, so we're doing our instructor introductions, and each one of us just kind of started talking about our why about the truck. Why are we doing this? Why are we doing that? Because we had some people from some different agencies and stuff like this. It was a really good perspective. And basically we spoke, the couple of us, just for doing our inductions, we spoke until about lunchtime. So we lost about half the day just during that discussion. And I was thinking, and every bit of that discussion was important. It was relevant. It was necessary. And I was just thinking, I was sitting there in the back of the room, and I was thinking, wow, we've got to share this with other people. We've got to share this with our students, because I don't want to waste that much time in this class. I want to be out there breaking stuff and, saving lives and breaking hearts, kind of thing. I want to be doing it. And we're sitting in a class talking about it. So I said, hey, what if I captured some of those ideas And I said, hey, I just want to put out a newsletter type of thing. And so that's kind of where it started. And so for the first couple of weeks of Veniner Search, it was like it didn't even have it was called Veniner Search, but it wasn't like a dedicated website. It was just like a, you know, on a subdomain and everything. And I was looking back at the traffic, and I was seeing internet traffic. I was seeing traffic from all over South. There were some from South Florida, some from North Florida. And I'm like, how do these people even hear about this? How do they even know about this? And what was happening was some of the people that were in that class that I shared that website with, again, it was just way to just all of a sudden they're passing it to other firefighters and other firefighters. And this traffic is coming from all these different places. And right then, I'd had some background in computer beforehand. At that point, I said, wait a second, there's potential here. Because at that time, you know, the magazines certainly had their websites and everything like that, but there wasn't a whole lot of content on them. And there was no social media back then. This is really old. So Facebook at that time, Facebook was still just on like college campuses. So Facebook wasn't even out in the masses. Twitter didn't even exist then, to put it in perspective, right? Or X or whatever, you know. And so this was just a way to get that message out. And when I saw the traffic from all these other places, I'm like, whoa, we got something going here. And that's kind of how it started. And it was just we were just doing some like articles basically, or just little blog posts about some of the why we were doing different things. And then we were sharing some like challenging forceful entry setups, and then like, hey, this is how we would talk about it, or different techniques. And it was hard, but we would try to start making some videos of it, stuff like that. And it was just a labor of love, a lot of love put into it. But that's kind of how it started, and that's ultimately that's ended up where we ended up making a company out of it, a training company, and everything. And Eric is just doing a fantastic job with that and the training we're going out with, and he's doing amazing stuff with that. So that's kind of the, I don't know that anything I ever say is quick, and my apologies on that.
You're fine.
It is. I'm a chief. That's why I just like to talk. But that's kind of how it started, right? Yeah.
Okay. And
Yeah.
he's definitely, you know, you laid the groundwork, and he's definitely
Yeah.
running with that thing like amazingly
Right.
now.
Yeah. Yeah. He's doing a fantastic job, and it was really cool to see, like, you know, because we were. At first, we were just doing some lectures, you know, like I would be like the lecturer, and we would travel all over, and Eric would come with and stuff like that. And then Eric kept bothering me. He's like, hey, we got to start doing the hands-on stuff. We got to start doing the hands-on. And I'm like, man, that'd be awesome. But that's tough, man. The logistics and everything. He's like, we got to do it. We got to do it. We got to do it. You know, and he's just, I mean, you know, Eric, he's got this level of motivation, and it just, fortunately or unfortunately, I got bit by that level of motivation. I'm like, all right, man, we start, because we were starting at this point. We were already going, we were teaching at like the Orlando Fire Conference. We were doing like the water can class at the Orlando Fire Conference, and we were teaching some of the other conferences in Florida. Like we'd go down to the Fort Lauderdale Fire Conference and everything. And he's like, man, we got to start doing this. We got to start doing this. And then we started doing it, and it was going really well. But again, there's a lot of moving parts with it. And then that was right when I had my situation happen. And so I just basically Eric took the company over and started running with it. The other thing was, is because I was, you know, a couple months away from being fire chief, it wasn't appropriate for me to have a business relationship with somebody inside the department. So we had already had it set up where in January of 18, my name was going to come off all the company stuff, you know, the licensing and all that stuff. And it was just going to be Eric. And then, of course, everything changed for me in August of 17. And then, you know, it just kind of organically, he was able to take it over and move on with it. So it worked out really well. And he's doing, I can tell you this right now, super proud of him, and I'm super proud of what he's doing. But he's doing a much better job than I could have possibly ever done. And it's just he's doing good work, man. He's doing good work.
But also looking at it, you were kind of the guiding beacon for him to to take it and run with it. And so what I'm getting at is, whether you knew it or not, you were a mentor to him. And as you can see now, look what he's doing for the rest of the fire service today.
That's awesome, man. It's thank you for saying that. And I do know that it's not something that I willingly kind of accept or whatever like that, but I do know it. I can tell you this, I had the opportunity. So, Eric is a second generation fireman in Winter Park. So I had the opportunity of working with his dad for many years. And his dad was there for years, a couple of years before me, obviously, but he and I got his dad and I got promoted to engineer at the same time, which was kind of cool. Fortunately, he had no, this is so funny, his father had no interest in the truck at all. So it was, I knew I was going to get the truck anyway. It was after his father retired, and his dad came up to me, and he's just like, listen, he's actually his dad came up and gave me a really big hug. And he just said, hey, I really appreciate everything you're doing for Eric. And I'm like, oh, I'm not doing anything. Eric, it's Eric's just, I maybe like cleared some of the grass out of his way, and he's just running, but he's like, man, he goes, you, he goes, and he just, and he hugged me. And it was like, dude, that was one of the, like, I'm actually kind of, it was one of the most impactful things, because his dad was, I always loved working with his dad. He was just hell of a fireman, hell of an engineer. But there were some things that we went over the years. We'd get tips and stuff like that. And when I was involved in the union, his dad would just, get mad at me at union meetings and stuff like that, whatever. To have that same guy come up to me and give me a hug and be like, hey, I'm like, damn, that was important.
Right. Okay. Love it. I
Yeah,
love
yeah.
it. So you know as well as anybody else how important VES is, and it's one of those things, it's kind of taboo in the fire service. And I say that because to me, it's only taboo if the individual or the organization can't realize the benefits to
Right.
conducting VES.
Right. Yeah.
So my question to you is, how important is it for organizations, even though they may not, you might have chief officers that might not want their members to do it, but it's a vital function on the fire ground.
It is the reason why every one of us, those chiefs included, it is the reason why every one of us went to fire school, why we put the badge on for the first time, and why we are doing what we're doing. We're doing that. Every one of us should have, and I guarantee you we have it all. We have some fluff in all of our mission statements these days and stuff like that. But I guarantee you there's something there about life and property, right? Life, okay? And every single one of us, some of those chiefs included, okay, if they were still able to do it, because some of them can't even do the job anymore or whatever, but anyway, any one of us would show up and want to go in. If there's a mom sitting going saying, my baby's in there, my baby's in there, how could you not want to go into that room? Okay, so if you have the reason why you're going in there is because there's somebody telling you that somebody's in there. Okay, good. But now you've already crossed the threshold that now it's acceptable, right? Okay, good. Great. We're halfway there. So why on earth we are professional, whether you're volunteer or not, you're professional firefighters, that you are dedicated to this craft. You put your bunker gear on. You're willing to risk your life for somebody else. Why on earth, what wouldn't you want to go in there and give that person the best chance to survive, right? Of course you would. So, okay. So for all those, so we passed all those checks so far, right? Or those tests so far. So why on earth, because now you're a chief officer and you're writing policies and stuff like that, why on earth would you want to take that away from your members, that they are not able to do that? Well, because it could be dangerous. Yeah, you're right. It could be dangerous. Firefighting could be dangerous. Showing up to work could be dangerous. Driving to work, everything, whatever. So we have to, okay, so it is our job to manage the risks as best we can. And the best way to we can is to train on it relentlessly and to properly prepare our firefighters for everything as best we can. And so why would we not do this? You know, it's so it's just funny that I understand there's the tremendous disconnect about if we shouldn't and we shouldn't. But if we go to the root of the question, we would all do it. Now, what happened along the way? Why are people now thinking that we shouldn't do it or whatever? And that's where we kind of lost it. You know, I remember there was an agency in the area of Winter Park that we used to provide truck company service with, and we were not allowed to use the term VES or vent enter search on the radio. We were not allowed to use that term on the radio. So they invited us into all their calls to be their truck company, but we were not allowed to use that term on the radio. But we could call it like a targeted search or something like that. And I'm like, okay, so you're telling me that we can actually do the tactic, but you're not comfortable with the name of it? Like, okay, so we're really like we're splitting hairs here, right? This is a big problem. And then the other thing was is for years we were teaching this and preaching this to you to use a tactic vendor search, and people were like, oh, it's not safe, it's not safe. But then all of a sudden, somebody threw the word isolate in there, and all of a sudden it was vent enter isolate search, and now it's more widely accepted. Okay. The problem I have with that is if you understood the tactic, you knew the isolation was there already. It was always there. It was part of the tactic. I just didn't need it in the name, right? And so that was a big thing. So funny story about that sideline here, but we were at FDIC one year, and we're out there, you know, having some brotherhood, you know, an establishment, having a couple beers or whatever. And somebody was just breaking stones for me, and they're like, "Hey, you know what? I'm gonna create the website," because I used to get very amped up when somebody called it vent and isolate search, and I'm like, "Man, that just pissed me off." He's like, somebody else goes, "I'm gonna make a website called vent and isolate search, and I'm gonna basically say everything against what you say." And I said, "Ha, you know what? I picked up my phone right there in the bar at FDIC, bought the domain vent enter isolate search, and forwarded it to vent enter search. So now if you go to either one of them, it goes to the same place." I'm like, "Nope, gotcha there. What's next?" Because it was, why are we so hung up on the words? Because every single, and back to what I was trying to really say earlier, every single one of us would do it if we're given that opportunity. If you pulled up on scene and you were the only person there, maybe you were not even, you weren't even there on a fire truck. You were just citizen because your neighbor knocked on your door and said, "My house is on fire, but my kid's in there." Wouldn't you at least try to go in and take, you know, like everybody's going to try to give them as much of a chance as possible, right? So why aren't we prepared for it? That's what citizens expect. So why don't we train for it? Why don't we prepare for it? Why don't we make, like, we're professional, man. Let's do this. You know, let's do this. Sorry, I get a little amped up with it because I'm like,
No.
oh, why is that even a question anymore, right?
No, I'm with you.
I'm
I'm with you.
fortunate. I'm fortunate. It's fortunate. I'm happy that departments are coming around to it. It is a lot more widely accepted now than it used to be. But there's still way too many questions out there about the viability of the tactic or whatever, and it shouldn't be. It's like firefighter 101 kind of stuff. You know, why would you go in? Why would I make you go into the front door and take a beating the entire time to get there to rescue the person? And what are you going to do? Are you going to rescue them? Are you going to pull them back through that same fire? That's stupid. Oh, you're going to open the window and push them out the window? Okay, cool. Why can't we just start with the window and get this done? And now we're 2 or 3 minutes ahead of schedule. The survivability of the victim goes up. The safety of our vict or of our survive or our firefighters goes up. I don't know, man. I mean, I know I'm retired now, but I don't see a problem with the tactic. I could give you a lot of reasons to do it and no reasons not to, right?
Okay. With
I'm
that
sorry.
being no, you're good. There's no need to apologize. With that being said, I'm gonna ask you, in your opinion, what does the term aggressive mean to you? Because that's another key word, another buzzword.
That is a very interesting word. Because so years so I had to look this up because I saw that you asked this question a couple of your other guests. So back in 2013, I taught a class at FDIC. So I was teaching FDIC for a number of years. In 2013, I changed my title for my class called, and it was called Aggressive Truck Companies or Aggressive Truck Functions for a Safer Fireground. And because I was aggressive, we are aggressive. We are firefighters. If we are not aggressive, we should go back, we should turn our badge in and go become police officers. We're aggressive. Okay. This is what we do. And I'm not trying to upset police officer. I'm just joking around. Their father was a cop, so I'm allowed to do it.
I
Anyway,
get it. I get it.
but the idea of the aggressive truck functions is we have, again, that's what the citizens are expecting us to be. They don't expect us to show up and half-ass the job. And I don't want to say it like that, but we have to be aggressive. That's what we do. They're paying us to do this job, and they're paying us to be perfect. Like so, yeah. So when I used that term, and this was again a handful of years ago, I didn't think I thought my class was going to get denied just because of the title change, and they let it slide. I'm like, ooh, okay, something's going on here. I kept that title for a couple of years, and then I changed it to intelligently aggressive truck functions. So I've been using this term. This is what I'm saying. I've been using that term aggressive for so many years, but it's not a bad word, and it's not a bad thing. I don't like that we have to start using a term like that to rebrand it and make it all sexy again. It's all firefighter stuff. It's all firefighter stuff. Any of these things, aggressive, not aggressive, tactically this or victim profile this, whatever. It's all firefighter stuff. We're just doing firefighter stuff. We're just doing firefighter stuff that needs to be done at the appropriate time, in the appropriate situation with the right training. And if we call aggressive, great. So I love the concept. Even though I'm sitting here telling you that I use the title myself, I don't, it should be the norm. It should be the norm. I'm just gonna say that it should be the norm. Right.
No, definitely. I 100% agree with you on that. 100%. When it comes to outside training, how important is it for members to, and I can't stress this enough, how important is it for members to get outside of the four walls of their organization or their fire station?
It is essential. You cannot stay. I don't care what agency you are with. You cannot stay within the walls of your organization. Okay. Because if you might go to a class in an outside agency in a different state, a different county, a different whatever, and you might realize you might go to that class, right? And you might realize, man, we're doing okay. Our department, we're doing okay. Like you know what? We're keeping up with things. Cool. If that's what you get out of it, cool. But I guarantee you're going to meet people and you're going to learn some things. You're going to be like, hey, you know what? There are some things. Maybe there's a little bit of a different way we could put our equipment together, or a little bit of a different way we could drag that person out, or different. And all we're doing is making ourselves better. So I'm not saying I don't like how overcomplicated some people are making some of the training. It doesn't have to be like that or whatever. But the only way you're going to do that is if you look outside of the walls of your agency, because it needs to be done, and it needs to be done often. Like I remember, I was very fortunate that throughout my career, we'd always had a educational reimbursement for training in our agency. And it, changed over the years, the amount of money. But from my first day, my first year, well, you couldn't take it your first year. So our city policy is you couldn't use your education reimbursement until you were a permanent employee. So after my second year of employment, when I could start taking it, every year I used every bit of that education reimbursement, 100% till the year that I retired. And I put in a lot of my own money above and beyond that as well. Some of that was for college classes, some of it was for, most of it was hands-on classes and stuff like that, conferences, always going to like FDIC and Firehouse and all those things. You have to get out of you have to get out of the walls of your agency and see what else is going out there. And the best way to do it is giving yourself that challenge to do it with some training. And the people you're going to meet and the conversations you're going to have. I've been to a lot of training. I did went through the my National Fire, I went to the National Fire Academy, went through the Executive Fire Officer Program and all those different stuff. I had to do all that stuff. And I learned more outside having a beverage, in the evening with with a fellow firefighter that happened to work in other side of the world, other side of the nation rather, because just different perspectives. So you have to get out of your area. You have to get out of the walls of your organization, and you have to learn from people. I mean, it's absolutely essential. So yeah, for sure.
And another piece of advice I can give to individuals too, and you mentioned that you did it because I continuously do this today. Even if your department's not going to pay for you, sometimes you need to swallow your pride or swallow that pill and make yourself better and spend your own money to
Right.
educate yourself.
100%, man. You have to do that. You have to do that. And then the other thing was, this is what kind of bothered me at one point. And one thing, I spent a lot of my own money doing classes, and some other people did as well. And then there was discussion about if we increase the educational reimbursement in our agency. And there were some of those people, they're like, no, we shouldn't, because I had to pay this money. I had to spend my own money. Why shouldn't this other person do it? I'm like, listen. And you don't know their situation. If the barrier to make them go to that class is the money, the least we could do is pay for it, right? Why would we not? Because it's going to make them a they're going to they're it's going to make them feel more valued. They're going to learn something. They're going to bring something back. And what's going to happen is when somebody comes back from class, always when somebody comes back from class, they have this new level of motivation, right? And why? I can't put a price in the amount of motivation that you come back. If you're one of my firefighters and you come back more motivated and you want to fix something in the agency or you want to do this training or whatever, I can't put a price on that. I would pay for your class just for you to go do it and come back and help me get more motivated, right? It's infectious. Performing outside training is like infectious in a good way, right?
Yeah, no, for sure. Okay. Now you were on the cusp. I mean, you were there literally about to be made head honcho of the organization. And I definitely, I'm going to let you have the floor with it because I want firefighters to understand a lot of us don't think, no, let me re a lot of us think we're going to go through our careers unscathed. Everything's going to be great. I will make my own terms when I am going to retire and things of that nature. And you're literally there about to get made, and then life throws you a wild card.
Wild card it was. So I had a very significant hemorrhagic stroke. I was on duty. I was at the fire station. I was in a staff meeting, and this is the only reason why I survived what I did. And I started getting a headache, which for me, having a headache at a staff meeting, very common, whatever. It is what it is, right? But and I lose perspective on how quick this was happening. But I think this what I'm about ready to tell you all happened very, very quick. But I remember seeing it, thinking, "Oh, I have a headache, no big deal." I'm like, "Wow, I need to get some like I need to get some like a lot Aleve or Tylenol or something. I just need the headache to go away." And then all of a sudden, I'm like, "Man, this is a really bad headache." maybe, and this is how dedicated to the agency I was and to my career and everything. I'm like, well, maybe I'll get checked out after the meeting. Because it had gotten to the point now, how, and I'm like, man, I need to get checked out because something's wrong. Again, just headache at this point, but it was a bad headache. And then again, it was probably just, I say a couple minutes, just probably a couple of seconds after that, was I realized that I was at this point, I'm slumped over in my chair. I'm, right-sided weakness, and I'm slumped over, and I'm thinking to myself, excuse me for a second, but I'm gonna say, shit, I'm having a stroke. And I knew it was happening. I was a paramedic. I was not a good paramedic. I never had any actual patient care experience. I was a medic by patch only, but I certainly knew that it was a stroke. And I remember trying to ask for help. Now everybody's in this meeting, but everybody's looking up at the fire chief. I think he was talking about something at board or something like that. So nobody was looking at me, and the chief wasn't looking at me. And so I tried to ask for help, and I just had slurred speech at this point. I was like, oh, yeah. And everybody's there. And I'm like, oh. And then all of a sudden they see that I was slumped over in the chair, and it was like, man, everybody knew. Nobody wanted to admit, but everybody knew that it was a stroke. So they called in a still alarm, and because I was at the fire station, but I was on the second floor. Administration was second floor of our firehouse. So the crews come up, and it was called in as a still alarm from a chief's radio. So that just doesn't make sense right now, right? And so they see me on the floor, and everybody else just kind of, and they thought it was because it was me, they thought it was a training thing. They thought I was just like messing with them, doing a training thing. So they thought, hey, oh, they're gonna make the chiefs, the chiefs are gonna make us, play like paramedics right now. And all of a sudden they looked and saw that look on everybody's face and realized, okay, this is real. So fortunately, they loaded me up in the rescue, in the ambulance, our transport unit, and it was unless it was like the eight it was 8 minutes from the time I said tried to say help me. I'm in the back of the ambulance heading to the hospital, and then it was 4 minute transport time from our station to the stroke center, which happened to be the closest hospital as well, fortunately. So in less than 15 minutes from me trying to say help, I'm at the hospital, which was the stroke center. So it was the best way that it could be if they don't have a stroke, don't ever have a stroke, right? But if it's going to happen, this is the best time or best way for this to happen. But before I go further into that, I just want to share the again, I knew it was happening. I just didn't want to admit that it was happening. And because again, I don't know if I mentioned it, I'm 41 at the time. I was 41 years old. And when I heard the medic call me in as a stroke alert, that messed me up, man. Again, I knew it was happening. That was like the first real confirmation. But when I heard me getting called in as a stroke alert, that was tough, man. And right away, I started thinking at that point, started thinking about my wife and kids and how they were going to find out. I was scared how they were going to find out about this. I still didn't even realize how bad it was or what was happening. Again, I knew it was happening. But so thinking about how my wife and kids were going to find out about this, so I was like, damn, this is not good. And yeah, so they got me up to scan, and they did a CT scan because obviously it's quick. And they realized I was having a hemorrhagic stroke, and what was at that time, the bleed was the size of an orange. On the scan, it was the size of an orange, and so I needed to get a craniectomy. So they rushed me to surgery, and they cut my skull open, and they took a big part of my skull off and took the bleed out, got all squared away, and then they had to leave my skull off for a couple of months. So my skull was off, or a big portion of my skull was off for a couple of months. And anytime I was out of bed doing therapy or anything like that, I had to wear like a helmet. I had to wear a helmet, and Unfortunately, I was a tech rescue guy and a truck guy and stuff like that, so I was kind of used to wearing helmets, you know. So funny story about that is they actually the guys, because the helmet they give you in the hospital is like the spongy kind of thing. It was just nasty looking or whatever. So the guys are like, this is not going to work. You know, this is we're Winter Park. It's got to look better than this. So they made it pro. They got me a full like tech rescue helmet and they got custom stickers made up and it said like Chief Walsh on it. There were flames on it and everything. Like it was cool. Like I looked pretty, you know, pretty awesome with it, as much as you can with a helmet on it like that. So I was there at the hospital for 3 weeks. I was there for 3 weeks, and in that time, I'm having full conversations with people and stuff, but I don't remember any of that. I remember like 3 to 5 memories from that 3 weeks. One of them was, you know, just conversations with my wife and I had. One of them, this is a great memory, but it's kind of a horrible memory at the same time. I remember my priest came and gave me communion. And that's it was a very beautiful, meaningful thing. But at the same time, that's pretty scary when your priest comes and gives you communion in the hospital. So that was just kind of a thing. And then I remember like one or two of the therapists, and that was really it. But again, I'm having full conversations with people in the hospital. I had so many, man, I tell you, the brothers and sister firefighters came in droves. They took care of me. They checked on me. I was never alone in the hospital when my wife had to leave to go get to pick up the kids from school and stuff like that. There were people there with me all the time. I had people staying with me all night. Firefighters would stay. They would take shifts staying with me. So if I woke up, I wasn't alone. And that was super cool. And then I went, then they transferred me up to Jacksonville, which is like 2 hours north of Orlando. And to a rehab hospital up there. And that's probably the best thing that could have happened is, as much as it was great that I had all the help here, I also needed to be outside of the area and I needed to just focus on my things and stuff. And so that was really great. And Jacksonville Fire Department, dude, they rose to the occasion. They apparently they called somebody from the department called them and said, hey, you know, this is one of our guys, he's coming up, whatever. Dude, they met us at when we turn off the interstate, they met right there. They met us right there, and they brought us, and you know, because I was in a rescue truck, but they brought us lights and sirens all the way into the rehab place. And so when they come to the rehab place, they knew I was coming, right? But they didn't know that I was coming with a contingent. So I had a bunch of people from Jacksonville Fire Department, a bunch of people from Winter Park Fire Department, my family, all just, and they just like it was amazing, dude. And I was there for 4 weeks, and it was again it was great. You know, family was there. My brother came. My brother came, and he was there with me every day. The only time he would so he lives in New Jersey, but he'd fly down. He would stay with me until my wife and kids could come up for the weekend, and then he would go back and do his thing and come back the next day or the next. So he was there the entire time, and Jacksonville again. Jacksonville Fire Department came and took care of me often. They brought me shift the meals. You know, they counted me in on shift meals and brought meals to the firehouse, meals to the rehab, which is awesome. You know, like it was the best thing. Yeah. So sorry, I know it was kind of a but yeah, it was. So I was also told real quick. I was also told that I would never walk again because of the damage and where it was. They told me they expected I would never walk again. And when, you know, so I was going back to the doctor that did the operation, and he's like, hey, you know, I saw you walk in with your cane and you, which I never thought you'd walk again. You know, I'm like, oh, dude, no way. So then the other thing was, is so because I had a craniectomy, so they removed a big part of my skull and kept my skull off, like I mentioned. So I had to eventually go back to the hospital and get my skull put back in. And it is my skull. It's held in with some titanium clips and some super glue. But anything. So I go back to getting about ready to get the my skull put back in, and the doctor goes, hey, I just saw your skull flap and everything's good. It looks viable. So surgery's gonna be good, everything. Do you have questions before the surgery? And I go, well, yeah, doc. He goes, okay. So he sits down real serious. He goes, well, what's your question? I go, well, the guys at the firehouse said they all signed it like a cast. can you verify they like signed it with a Sharpie? And the doctor, he had no idea. Like he thought I was serious, and he's just like, and this doctor just, and I'm like, dude, I'm just joking. It's like Firehouse Humor, man. Like he just, you know. So yeah, the the medical community, even though some of them are very familiar with our Firehouse Humor, apparently brain surgeons are not. So yeah, so.
So I definitely, I mean, you started out the interview where you wanted to be an F-16 pilot, and that didn't happen. So then the man upstairs threw you a different road to go down, and you got into the fire service. And then you never thought you wanted to be a jam-up firefighter, but then you ended up climbing through the ranks, almost getting to fire chief. Even though fire chief didn't happen, you still have to say to yourself, like, you got to be able to count your blessings, right?
Oh, 100%, man. 100%. Listen, I don't wish what happened to me on anybody, and I wish that, and I'll explain something more about why that happened or whatever, but I don't wish what happened to me on anybody, but I probably wasn't paying attention to some of the messages that the man upstairs was giving me about stuff like that. And I'm glad. Looking, I'm glad I didn't get that fire chief job, because it would have caused me more pain in my life and with my family and stuff like that. And I was so into the job and so into what I was trying to do. And I was going to be the best fire chief I could possibly have been, because I was so, all I wanted to do was, be there for the, for our people, for our firefighters, and give them, set them up for success and do all those things. But I was probably not, not paying attention to is not the right term, but I wasn't focusing enough on family. And as much as I tried to do that, I always tried to be like the family guy and the fire guy and all these different things. I was kind of kidding myself. And so I needed not to be in the fire service anymore. I needed this to happen. I needed not to get that job. And I wish it didn't happen this way,
Right.
but I'm glad it happened, because I'm a much better dad. I'm a much better husband, and I'm still learning how to be the best dad possible, and I'm still learning how to be the best husband possible. But I'm never going to stop trying to do those things. Those are my priorities now. I'm still involved in some other things and teaching things and stuff like that, locally, but I'm just trying to focus on being a good dad and a good husband, right?
Preach it. Yeah, love it. Love it. Okay. With that being said, even though you didn't officially, I don't want to say you, because you were there. You didn't hold the throne. So with that being said, what does the term leadership mean to you? Like, what does leadership look like?
Man, leadership looks so many, so different in so many different ways, depending on the situation and what you're looking at. Like, so because I had leaders early in my career. I had leaders that I worked for and looked up to and stuff like that, that helped me along the way, but they helped me at that level, and they probably were only going to be able to help me at that level. And that sounds horrible to say, but it'll kind of, maybe hopefully it'll make sense all in a second. A big part of, listen, you can hold rank and be a really crappy leader, and you don't have to have rank to be a really good leader. And I wish the fire service understood that a little bit more. And I think people like yourself and myself that are kind of dialed into the job and love the, they get it, right? But unfortunately, there's a lot of people in the fire service that don't understand that. And even more importantly, there's a lot of people like in perhaps at City Hall or County Hall that don't get that or don't appreciate that. And so that's a whole nother story there. But leadership is absolutely essential, and I wish it was taught better and different and all these different things. But you just got to be consistent, and you have to be. I'm sorry, I can't even remember the specific question now because I'm just going on a rant
No,
here.
you're fine. You're
Yeah,
fine.
this is man, it's Yeah, I think just the big thing I was saying there is just the man, again, some of the best leaders I ever knew did not hold any rank. Some of the worst leaders I've ever known held a lot of bugles,
Right.
you know?
Yeah,
And so the
definitely.
other thing, real quick on that, the other thing is that sometimes we're not promoting the right people. And a reason why we're not promoting the right people is because our assessment center is broken. Like, you shouldn't be just able to be a really good test taker, and all of a sudden now you're the next person wearing the badge or whatever, right? So like when I first took over training, our assessments were broken. We weren't assessing the right things, and sometimes we had people that were getting promoted that weren't the best candidates. And so it took a long time, but we worked really hard to change the promotional process to make sure, still within, all of our union rules and everything like that, and everything, but we got everybody on board with the fact that it was like, wait a second. We're actually getting the right people to take that job because the assessment center is fixed better. I'm not saying it was perfect. It definitely wasn't perfect, right? But it was definitely getting better. And I think our agencies, we that's what we need to be focusing on, is making sure we're promoting the right people for the right reasons.
No, for sure. For sure on that one.
Right.
I always like to ask the guests this question, but I'm gonna have to rephrase it because you pretty much medically retired out. So the original question is, where would you like to see yourself before you decide to hang it up? So I'm gonna rephrase it to, now that you are retired, what's next? What's in the future for Jim Walsh?
I'm still trying to figure out what I want to be when I grow up.
Ha.
Even though I am retired, I'm still trying to give back to the fire community in some way. Like, I still teach classes at the local college. I teach both like some of our degree classes from our program there, and then also I just started, and I just not never did this before, but I'm just teaching like minimum standards, like our recruit classes. I'd never basically, when my teaching career started, it was just strange how it all worked out. So I didn't ever teach those classes, and actually now I'm really enjoying teaching those classes. So that's kind of what I'm still doing now in the fire service, in a very different way. But teaching was always a passion of mine, so it's really cool that I'm still able to do that. But really, I'm just and right now I'm just trying to be a good dad and a good husband. I've said it before, that's kind of the most important thing for me. My family's always been there. And you know what? Here's the, and I want to make sure everybody else understands this, is your family is there for you too. You might not realize it. You might not think that you need it in this way or whatever. But man, it's just when the chips are down, those are the people that are staying there, you know? I still have plenty of people that love and respect me that were in Winter Park and stuff like that. But I showed up to the firehouse one day, and I don't go to the firehouse often, but I went to the firehouse one day to get a pension form signed. We basically, every year we have to get this form signed that basically says you're still alive and you're still getting your pension. And because all of my legal signatures was when I was right-handed, and now I'm left-handed, my signature doesn't look the same. So I go to a place that they can verify. Anyway, the reason why I'm saying is I went to the firehouse and I didn't know anybody. The first three people were there, I didn't even know. And it wasn't until the fourth person was somebody that actually knew me. And then once they said my name, they're like, "Oh, we've heard Jim Walsh." I'm like, oh, I don't know. That's a good thing or a bad thing, whatever. But so, I just want to make sure that I feel like I did this. I feel like I made the fire service better while I was there. I still want to try to keep my fingers in it a little bit at the fire college. But right now, I just want to be a good dad, a good husband, and travel more. That's it. That's what I want to be when I grow up.
And to me, the silver bullet, the silver lining in what you just said is the fact that there are individuals out there who think, and I've said this before, but I always like to reiterate it because I think it's very profound if you really think about it. There are individuals who think as soon as they leave here, they're going to be known. And that's not the case because The organization is going to continue to move without you. They're going to continue to hire people. And if you go visit or stop by, you'll ring the door. Somebody will come and answer it. They will not know you and just look at you like, oh, yes, sir, or ma'am, can I help you? And it's one of those, I don't want to say it's a gut feeling, but it's a reality that you can love the fire service. Undoubtedly, go to all the trainings, be all into the job for your career, have multiple citations, whatever the case may be. But there's going to be a day where you're not going to be able to do it anymore. And if all you have is those citations and those plaques, but your actual family, your family members are nowhere to be found, it's going to be a lonely world for you.
Yeah. I mean, the whole thing, I always wanted to get to retirement so I can enjoy retirement with my family, right? Listen, my friend, I almost didn't make it to retirement because of all the stress I was putting myself under to be the best firefighter and the best fire chief officer and ultimately the fire chief. I almost lost that opportunity, and my family almost lost that opportunity, right? It's not worth it, right? I love that job, and here's the thing is, why did I think any different? That fire department was there for 98 years before I started there, right? And I've been gone 8 years now, 7, 8 years, and they're still doing it. I think I said it before, they're still doing it. Not as well as if I'm there, but they're still doing it, right? And you know what? And there's things they're doing better, right?
Right.
At the company level and stuff like that. So it's just, this job is amazing and this career is amazing. And I've met so many fantastic people, and my life is truly better because of it. But it's going to go away sometime, and you're not. And some people, unfortunately, I would say most firefighters aren't ready for that.
Yep.
And I've seen so many people. Like, for example, in our situation, we have the drop program, right? So we have a program where you basically have to announce your retirement, and we have a 7-year drop. Okay, so it's a long time, and there's people that 7 years ago, it sounded like the best decision they could possibly make. But as they come close to that drop date, it's hard for them to leave. And then all of a sudden, once you lose that tribe and the firehouse, you don't miss the BS. You miss the firehouse shenanigans. You miss the stories. You miss the breaking stones. You miss all those, the practical jokes, all those different things. That's what you're going to miss. And so we need, and this is one of the things I'm kind of working on now, as I want to work on, is I want to figure out a way that we can keep our retirees closer together. And I know some other agencies that are doing this, and bigger agencies, they'll do like a monthly breakfast or a meetup or something like that, or dinner out one night or drinks one night, whatever. And our agency doesn't have that many retirees. We're getting a lot more now, obviously. But we're like once a quarter, we do this. We try to once a quarter, we get together at like the Irish pub in town or whatever, and just, hang out and tell stories and make fun of each other. 'Cause that's the part you're going to miss, man. You're not going to miss the unknown medical at 3 in the morning. That novelty, Jan, that novelty wears off really quick. Like sleeping through the night. I wake up in the middle of the night now. It's just because I need to go to the bathroom because I'm getting old. It's not because I need to, because there was this call in the middle of the night, right? But yeah.
It just only answer this if you feel comfortable. But was the cause of your stroke due to the stress and wanting to just be the because I know, and I'm putting myself in this, myself included, man, I can get here recently. I'm trying to do a lot better, and I think I've finally figured it out ish in a way, but I would get worked up on why this person doesn't care, why we're not doing this, why we're not doing that, to the point where, I'd come home and it was like affecting my mood and stuff. And I'm like, you know what? Like, why? Why am I doing this to myself? Like it. So what I do now, I go in, I do my job as a firefighter. And then when I leave work, I freaking leave it. I do not care what happens when I'm not there.
Yeah, I applaud you for that, man, 'cause that is 100% the way it needs to be. I was not able to separate like that. And I was able to, because I was so focused. I'm like, man, I gotta first, I was so focused on trying to get to the point where I was going to be, respected in the agency and my opinion valued and all these different things. Then once they started listening to me, it was like, man, I gotta perform. I gotta perform. So I want, and I wanted to do the best for the and all these different things. And I kept putting more stress on myself and more stress on myself. So 100% my stroke was because of stress. 100% it happened because I wasn't taking care of myself in the way that I should. I was always borderline high blood pressure. When I say borderline, I was like in the one, my normal blood pressure was like in the 130s over 80s. It wasn't hypertensive, but it was right there. That was when I'm getting my physical and stuff like that. What I never really did was figure out what my blood pressure was when I was at work, getting all jammed up about something and everything else. It was probably much higher. And I was very excitable. We'll just say this. Nobody at work would be surprised. Nobody wanted it to happen to me, whatever, but it was like, oh, his stroke was blood pressure related. That checks out. Like it didn't surprise anybody when they realized it. But why my stroke was 100% blood pressure related, and it was 100% because of the stress I was putting myself under. And so I just want to make sure that you and all the listeners and stuff like that take care of themselves and their blood pressure. This is the thing, dude. Listen, every one of us has been on a call and transported people because of high blood pressure, right? And we know the signs and symptoms. We know what they need. We know what we get all of it. But then we don't take care of ourselves in that same way. So, just yes, my stroke was because of blood pressure. It was because of the stress I was putting myself under. And yeah, that's it almost, I mean, you really can't get any closer to almost my life than that situation. So yeah, it was stress, man. It was stress.
Chief, I really appreciate you coming on, man. I have to give a shout out to Chief Wheaton. After I did his interview, we talked one-on-one, and I was like, hey, Chief, if you got anybody that you know in mind, and he's like, yeah, I got a guy. He's like, his name's Jim Walsh. And then he gave me a little brief synopsis about you. And I was like, he's like, are you interested? I said, hell yeah, absolutely. Send me his message and or send me his info and I'll contact him and everything else. So Chief Wheaton, if you're listening to this, thank you very much. Jim, I really appreciate you coming on, talking shop, talking about things you didn't have to open up about. But I think the message can be very vital to any other listeners out there because we all know most into the job, go get them, hungry firefighters don't like complacency. We get amped up on things we can't change, and we need to learn that there are certain things that are out of our control. Let that happen. Do what you have to do, affect who you can affect, and then just keep it moving. But thank you for coming on, sharing your story. Thank you for being the OG of VES. Thank you for laying down the groundwork for Chief Wheaton to, like I said, he's doing his thing out there on social media, helping departments across the country that need help. So thank you for your time today. I really appreciate this.
Absolutely, man. Thank you. Thank you for the opportunity.
Yes, sir.
If any of the listeners out there are or know of a great firefighter who embodies the principles of being a great communicator, goal-oriented, hardworking, humble, passionate, and professional, regardless of rank, career, or volunteer, contact me at studentofthegamefirepodcast@gmail.com. Until next time, stay focused, stay committed, and stay safe.